Good morning. I'm Mark Reilly here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition. How you doing? It's Wednesday morning. Good morning, single moms. Good morning, truckers. Good morning, bakers. Good morning, folks who are in different time zones. Good morning to people who are listening to us overseas via the internet. Good morning to all. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Reilly. Mark Maron is out this week on a well-deserved vacation. The first 2 days this week we had Mick Foley in studio, and it is a pleasure to welcome to our microphones guest co-host Ms. Laura Flanders.
Hey, Mark. So it's okay, you allow non-wrestlers here in this seat?
Yeah, non-wrestlers, non-big people, because Mick Foley is a big guy, I gotta tell you.
Bigger than you, Mark?
Much bigger than me. I saw him walking down the hall the other day. He is the biggest guy we've had in this studio since Shaquille O'Neal.
I'm beginning to think size matters.
Well, I don't know. You'll have to talk to Mick about that one. Laura, how you doing?
I'm doing well. You know, they barely let me out during the weekdays because my weekend show keeps me so busy. So it's kind of fun to see that there is a live and well activities on a Wednesday. Who knew?
Absolutely. Laura Flanders, of course, hosts the Laura Flanders Show weekend 7 to 10 p.m. right here on Air America Radio. She's also the author of Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species. And we're going to get into some of the substance of your book. We talk a little bit about Karen Hughes. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about today. There's been, for those of you who are just waking up, there's been yet another decision in the Terri Schiavo case. We'll get to that and all of that grim news. But I got to tell you, Laura, yesterday I went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art after mistakenly thinking that my wife and daughter wanted to go to the Museum of Natural History. So we go all the way up the west side of Manhattan to 81st Street, and then they say, oh, no, this isn't the right museum. We got to go across town. But we went to the Met, and I got to tell you, I didn't actually walk my daughter through this exhibit. She had gone.
She might have liked it.
She might have liked it, but she had gone to the Met with her school class, and she wanted to go back. So we went back in, and she wanted to see the Temple of Dendor, which she didn't get a chance to see, mm-hmm. and the Chinese Gardens, a bunch of stuff. So while she and my wife were doing that, I decided to go see Revelations, which is a photographic exhibit of the work of Diane Arbus, a legendary photographer. Laura, I got to tell you, I am not a picture person. I don't like to take them. I don't like to be in them. I'm just not a photograph type person. But this particular exhibit rendered me absolutely speechless. Speechless. It was a stunning exhibit. For those of you who don't know about Diane Arbus, she was a young lady who grew up here in New York City, went to Fieldston, one of the most prestigious schools in New York, where she met and later married Alan Arbus, the actor, and she learned photography from him. He had learned it in the service during the war. And she worked in fashion photography for a number of years and then decided to go out on her own. She became estranged from her husband, and she decided to start photographing what she wanted to photograph. And I have to tell you, Laura, there's some stuff in there that just floored me. There was a picture that she did in 1962 of some people leaving a peace demonstration against the black, you know, this is all black and white stuff, but against the sunset. And there are these people walking across this ridge with their posters kind of like at half staff. It was just incredible. There was also a picture from 1966 of James Brown in the middle of having a curler taken out of his head. You know, she liked to do different, I mean, she liked to take pictures of nudists and transvestites.
Well, she really was. I mean, she was one of the people that really gave humanity to the weird and wacko people of this country and gave a kind of depth to people who hadn't been seen in all their sort of humanity, I think. She was somebody that really, it seems to me, did a lot to try to get people to look again at people they might otherwise have ignored. From the transvestites and the nudists, although it's hard to ignore either of those, to the homeless and the elderly and the strange folks that you see. She pointed that camera. She gave beauty to characters who had only ever been kind of bit players or made fun of. Amazing work. Amazing work. And from a fashion photographer who said, enough of this. Let's not just talk about the beauty people. You know, let's talk about the whole realm, the whole range of human expression and human existence. And really powerful work.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, what stunned me, Laura, was that some of the faces that I saw, some of the images that I saw in this photographic exhibit, reminded me of when I was a very young kid. There was a picture of a black couple dancing with a guy with a baggy coat on and a pork pie hat. And I said, that looked like the same guy that used to come to my father's house to watch the Friday Night Fights when I was like 7, 8 years old. This stuff is so evocative. I mean, and to take ordinary stuff and make it look like, a shot of a movie theater, shot up from a to the projectionist booth with the audience sitting up in the balcony. Stuff like that, that is a very, mundane, normal picture. But to give it such depth and nuance was just incredible to me.
Well, I went to see a photo exhibit yesterday, too.
Really?
Must have been the day for it.
Uh-oh.
I went to see the Gregory Colbert Show over on the West Side.
Okay.
If you're in New York, you see these incredible ads now, which feature elephants and kids with their eyes closed. I thought it was Benetton ads for a very long time. I don't know what that means about American culture, but first I thought it was an ad for a product, and then I found out it was actually promotion for an art show. You know, the art wasn't really my thing, I have to say. It was a little, I couldn't quite get out of the Benetton ad, but the place it's showing is amazing.
Really?
It's called the Nomadic Museum, and it's built on an old pier on the West Side, and they've created a structure out of old containers, like freight containers.
You're kidding.
Yeah, it's kind of beautiful, and concrete pillars, encased in cardboard. It has a real sort of recycled look to it, and it's an amazing space with these very sort of otherworldly images of animals and humans. He's trying to convey, we're all in a spiritual continuum, the human and the animal. I don't know. It all looked a bit like advertising, but it's an amazing experience. You should go check it out if you're in the New York area.
I definitely have to go check it out. You know, it's interesting, Laura, we're going to talk this morning a bit about water later on. And I had my own experience with water when our water heater at home went on the fritz yesterday. And I get up in the morning, get the water's cold, it won't heat up. Then I go downstairs, I realize there's a leak in the water heater and there's water all, and then I had to turn the water off. We went through the bulk of the day without water.
And what did you learn, Mark?
I learned that there's certain things that you do by reflex. There was at least 5 different times during the day yesterday after we got home from the Met where I turned on the spigot. I should have known, because I turned it off, that the water wasn't even on.
Yeah, well, it was World Water Day
yesterday.
And the numbers are just incredible. The UN reminded us 1.1 billion people around the world lack water that they can drink. 2.4 have no access to sanitation. 3 million deaths caused by that alone. And, of course, around the world, and even in this country, there are fights about the privatization of water. Some of the big companies that you're familiar with, Bechtel, Enron, they know, just like you found out yesterday, water is absolutely crucial to human life, and it is the next oil in a certain sense, in that there is a finite amount of water we can use, and it is increasingly a valuable private commodity. And we're seeing struggles all around the country, Stockton, California, Detroit where
sure.
People are having their water cut off. And it's kind of an interesting counterpoint to this whole Chavo story, where you have, the whole world focusing for a day yesterday on water and the shortage of and the availability of and the number of, wars that get fought over water resources. And what are we focusing on in this country? One person and this feeding tube and all the shock horror about hunger and thirst and this one person. It's really stark contrast.
Yeah, it is a very stark contrast. And if you start looking at the efforts to privatize water, one of the things I did not know was that there were many, many lives saved in the wake of the Boxing Day tsunami. By people being able to get access to potable water before they, literally dehydrated to death. And I think it's important to realize that there are a lot of people put a lot of effort into doing that, but it, again, spotlights the idea that water, call me a flaming radical here, Laura.
You're a flaming radical, Mark.
Thank you. I think water is a right. You know what I'm saying? I think, you kind of sort of have to have it, and I think it ought to be viewed as a right. I'm not sure that it is in this country, maybe people don't think of it that way, but I really believe that people of the world, there is no excuse for millions, if not billions of people, not having access to clean, potable water. Now, we got to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about the latest decision in the Terry Schiavo case. We're not going to tell you what it is until we come back, but it goes on and on and on. Stay with us. This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition,
the highest rated, most respected news show in America
on Air America Radio.
Good morning, fat horn sections. Because that's a fat horn section. I just want you to know that. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. Our special guest co-host, the host of the Laura Flanders Show, heard weekends here on Air America, 7 to 10 p.m. is Laura Flanders.
Hey, Mark. It's so great to be here with you. You know what I think happened since the last time we did the show together? I think spring.
Is that what it is?
One of those things. It's warm, it's sunny, it's gorgeous on the East Coast.
I'm sure it's going to
be the same way. Well, it's always the same way almost on the West Coast. I was just out there. How fantastic is that? But it's like a different feel in the air. The last couple of days sent you and I off to see art shows. It must have been a weird perversion of spring fever, I think. But nonetheless.
No, well, you know, we may get a little drop of snow here in the New York.
You're kidding.
Not gone completely winter.
Oh, come on.
Let me tell you something.
Happy spring, folks.
Happy spring. I have to say, Laura, talking about a bizarre segue, as far as media is concerned, there is a winter of our coverage of the Terri Schiavo case, I have to say. Now, at about 2:30 this morning, the three-judge panel of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, which is based in Atlanta, Georgia, ruled that it had to honor the rule of law, stick to the lower court judgment. That was the judgment of U.S. District Judge James Whitmore of Tampa, Florida, that said that the feeding tube that Terri Schiavo had been using to stay alive would be taken out. So the courts, the federal appeals court, you know, following the rulings of, I don't know how many other ones, a whole bunch of other courts, ruled in a 2-1 vote to uphold Judge Whitmore's ruling. Laura, you pointed out, and, you know, there's so many facets and aspects to this case, it's almost scary. There's the question of how it's being covered. There's the question of congressional oversight and possible congressional overstepping in terms of states' rights. There is the question of whether or not this is some grand ploy on the part of conservatives in the House, specifically Majority Leader Tom DeLay, to divert attention from his own problems and divert attention from things like, you know, Bush's failed Social Security privatization. Not failed yet, but certainly it seems to be on the skids, his Social Security privatization. All of these problems, some people believe, are being masked by this media onslaught in terms of the coverage of the Terri Schiavo case.
Well, they sure are trying, and we ain't seen nothing yet, as you said. We've got weeks still to go here of this. But it's fascinating. You're right. I mean, now the case goes to the Supreme Court. Now, this is the third attempt to bring this case to the Supreme Court. Already in January, Jeb Bush, in a sense, tried to get the Supreme Court to take a look at it. They refused to listen to his challenge of the Florida court's verdict on the case. As recently as last Friday, the Supreme Court again let stand the Florida court's decision on the tube being removed. So this is the third time round, once on the governor's behalf, once kind of on the president's behalf. They're not going to have any more success with this than they have had before. The Supreme Court is not going to take this case. And it is about politics, and I wrote about it this week.
Yes.
It's not about Terri Schiavo, it's about everything but, and it's about trying to get those poor Christian folks who voted for Republicans in November to ignore the fact that they've got nothing from this Congress yet, except for, as I put in the piece, you know, a slap around the face with a knuckle-duster budget for millionaires and a tougher time for folks who go bankrupt when they're poor. I mean, this is a Congress that when it actually gets into its second, you know, re-inaugurated, you come in for your second session, your second term here as president, you want to get your priority issues accomplished. What do they go for? They don't go for the social issues that social conservatives voted for. They don't go for choice or marriage or any of that stuff. They go for business, and they go for bankruptcy law. And this is their chance to say, hey, wait a minute, we do care about your issues. Look, we're going to stand up for the culture of life. It's baloney, and I don't think they're getting away with it. I mean, the interesting thing to me in all this, the way that it's playing out, and there was an article on it in the Washington Post yesterday, is that this isn't going down well with all conservatives.
Not at all.
I mean, A, you have the justice community, the lawyers, who are very concerned about the violation of states' rights. I mean, you know, when they choose to, the right like that, states' rights stuff. Not to have to enforce civil rights law and not to have to do this and that. This is stepping all over that type of policy. It's also stepping all over the respect for the sanctity of marriage, because it's all about challenging Schiavo's husband's right to make decisions in her name.
And how did they do that? They got the one doctor in Congress, Bill Frist, to look at some videotape and come to a different conclusion than the... See, people seem to
And he's
to
not
think,
a neurologist, let's not forget. He's a surgeon.
Exactly. And people have framed this discussion as if Michael Schiavo himself made the decision that she was in this persistent vegetative state when, in fact, it was doctors who made that decision. But Frist looks at it. He's a doctor. So now suddenly, you know, there is a contrasting opinion.
But it is amazing. I mean, when they're talking about gay people getting married, oh, we can't allow anything to infect or destroy the sanctity of marriage. And here you have a marriage being dragged through the courts, you know, case off time after time after time after time. But, you know, the polls, ABC poll yesterday, 63% of people polled support removing this tube. 67% believe it's about politics, what Congress is doing. You know, the conservative rank and file American is not going for the delay case on this. They're looking at this and thinking, this could be my family. This has been in my family, and I don't think it's flying. You've got this massive email campaign from people far away organized by right-wing groups, but you have, what, 15 people protesting outside the hospice?
15 people, and they spent, apparently, somebody, one of the published reports, it might have been the Associated Press, seemed to spend a whole bunch of time talking to one of those people. But, Laura, is this the issue where the Republicans overreach and show their hands as overreachers? That's what Ted Kennedy is saying.
Yeah, well, I think they're overreaching. The sad thing to me is that the Democrats are being as reticent and feel that they're in a position where they have to be so reticent when there really is a popular constituency for a very sane voice just saying, come on, people. Come on, people. Let's not do this.
Yeah. Well, there have been some really cogent voices, the voice of Barney Frank. Later this morning, we're going to talk to Congressman Jerry Nadler from right here in New York. There have been some voices that have said, look, you know, you're treading on ground that is really, really shaky here. But there's the other hidden Bush agenda, and that is his judicial nominees. See, because now the Republicans have portrayed the judiciary, even people that are Republicans in the judiciary, as being out of control. All of these different judges are tyrants, and they're this and they're that. As a matter of fact, one of the demonstrators out in front of the hospice where Terry Schiavo is said, you know, these are all of them are tyrants. They're despots, and they have to be dealt with as such.
So watch out, you 11th Circuit, you.
Yeah, and believe me, the 11th in Atlanta and the 9th on the West Coast.
Oh, you bet.
Two big priorities for George W. Bush. When we come back, the president's palm pilot. Is it the president? I think it's the president. Yeah. Whoever's palm pilot we got a palm pilot for you. And then we're going to come back, talk about water, because yesterday was International Water Day.
World Water Day.
World Water Day. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Good morning. It's 34 past the hour. It's Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. Didn't they used to call this like speed music back in the day, Laura?
I'm speeding.
Laura Flanders is our special guest co-host. Now, you would think because Maron's not in town, we wouldn't get the presidential palm pilot because Ramon somewhere, from what I hear, is somewhere out in Northern California doing whatever it is that Ramon does when he goes to Northern California. But we've got someone who's able to access that palm pilot anyway, and here he is, Kent the Colonel Jones.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning, Laura. I have the president's palm pilot today. President Bush is in Texas, turning his charm offensive on President Fox of Mexico and Prime Minister Martin of Canada. And here we go. 6 a.m. Wake up in Crawford. Breakfast. Or should I say, insert feeding tube.
Ew.
I crack me up. I'm hilarious. 8 a.m. Go to Waco. Note, words to avoid. Davidian, Koresh, FBI, Bloodbath, Reno, or Janet. 9:30 a.m., meet with President Vicente Fox of Mexico and Prime Minister Paul Martin of Canada. Get tough. Remind them that in terms of world influence, the U.S. is Tony Orlando, Canada and Mexico are Dawn. 11:25 a.m., press conference with Fox and Martin. Make joke about giving reporters the Fox News. Wait for laughs. I kill me. 1:25 p.m., go to Crawford. Lunch with Fox and Martin. Repeat feeding tube joke, this time in Spanish and in French. See if it works a little better. 2:30 p.m., give Fox and Martin a tour of the Bush Ranch. point out all the different places where I wrecked my bike. Look over there. That one hurt. Ow. 7 p.m. Introduce Fox and Martin to Crawford Nightlife. Pop open a couple of near beers and show them how to use the Xbox.
Ooh.
That'll do it.
Thank you, Colonel.
Thank you.
We appreciate
we'll
that.
See you later.
See you later. Laura Flanders, if it wasn't for the fact that you are here this morning, I would not have known that yesterday was World Water Day. I would not have known.
It's important to have somebody keeping track of these things, you know, that the World Something Day just about every week, and you have to pay close attention.
Well, you know, what's fascinating about World Water Day is that it comes now at a time when the forces of privatization are on the march, not just here in the United States, but worldwide. And what fascinates me about this is that we see, for example, George W. Bush pursuing a Social Security privatization scheme that has not worked in other parts of the world, and now we're seeing the same kind of thing go on with water, where people are marching toward this privatization, where in certain parts of the world, where it's already in place, it has been an abject and miserable failure.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some interesting reporting on this just today, because yesterday was World Water Day, and I think that's partly why we have these world days about things, because it gives us 2 minutes to actually pay attention to some of the important issues around the world. Yeah, I mean, there's a group apparently in Britain, the Public Services International Organization, which analyzes privatization and restructuring of public services of different kinds. They had a recent study that Sri Lanka's capital, Colombo, where water's publicly managed, the leakage level is only 23%, right, compared to 35% for the City of London, which is run by Thames Water Company, which is one of the companies in coalition with other multinationals that's been buying up water supplies in this country. Stockton, California, huge fight where local people demanded a right to have a vote about the privatization of the water. Thames Water was one of the companies in that group that wanted to privatize and buy. The mayor of Stockton went along with the companies against the people, got voted out of office.
Popular really?
Guy. He ran for higher office, didn't get anywhere. I mean, this is a huge battle happening in this country now. We've seen the privatization of just about everything. Are we really going to allow the privatization of our water? Are we going to allow our water to be for profit, not for people? Water for life, these folks said. And the public should have a right to say. It's also fascinating, again, we were talking about the contrast with the Chievo story, where this whole concern about cutting off some water supplies. You know, in Detroit, where there's been another tussle about privatization, thousands of people have been being cut off from their water. I read one report, 40,000 people shut off water between June of 2001 and June of 2002. That's just Detroit. Enron, interestingly, one of the big water companies around the world, was just given a real rejection by the people of Uruguay. And mm-hmm. I know that you've been looking at the politics of South America.
South America.
It's fascinating
yeah.
what's going on there. But Uruguay just voted against having any water privatization.
None?
And remember what happened in Bolivia,
yeah.
Where you had folks literally going up against the force of the military to protest water privatization. Remember the Cochibambinos, they were
yes.
called, the people from Cochabamba, Bolivia. This was their fighting issue because they know what happens next. They've seen the privatization of schools, of health care, you name it. You start privatizing water, charging people by the gallon, you know who's going to get it and who's not going to get it. And I think most of the world agrees with you, Mark. This is a human right.
I would hope it would be seen in the 21st century as a human right. But what happens when people end up getting their water privatized is usually this. Not all the time, but usually. You get rates that go up. You get a predatory attitude toward the consumer. You get people getting cut off, as you mentioned in Detroit. Even though their system is still municipally owned at this point, there is this push toward privatization. There's the whole notion that you have to increase rates. There is the whole idea that you have to make a profit.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? You're not just providing a service to people. You have to make a profit for the shareholders.
Yeah.
And that changes the whole equation.
Yeah, and, you know, in some cases, Laura, we see situations where the water is going from public hands to private hands and then sold back to consumers. And it creates a situation where, and I think on a certain level, American consumers don't pay that much attention. I didn't know when my family moved from New York to New Jersey. In New York, you just kind of take water for granted. You know, it's everywhere. You open the spigot, there's the water. Well, when you move into a private house, you move out of New York, suddenly you are at the mercy of whatever water company supplies your stuff. And usually there is no option. Usually these folks seem to have a monopoly in different towns. And one of the big water delivery services, United Water, which I believe is based somewhere in Europe, they also supply my water. Now, I don't really give a great deal of thought to it. That's largely because my wife pays the bills, bless her. But bottom line, every so often I get this bill in there from United Water. And they are a big conglomerate like Thames, like you mentioned earlier, that is out to make a profit out of providing this crucial ingredient to human life. Now, you know, we live in a capitalist society. I'm not here to say that we have to go communist or whatever, because you know how folks get when you start talking about,
I can hear the bells ringing right now.
Yeah, when you start talking about guaranteeing people, especially people of limited means, when you start talking about guaranteeing them things, people go crazy, whether it's health care or whether it's water or whether it's a good education. People just seem to have a problem with making guarantees of basic rights to the poor.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. The woman who got the Nobel Peace Prize this year, Wangari Maathai, from Kenya, who talked about, she has a multinational African campaign now across that continent to try to draw the connection between ecology and peace and conflict between communities. And she's been focusing on trees and land. But water is the same thing. I mean, you look at the Middle East, you look at struggles that are now, cast as religious or sectarian in one way or another. Really, what's at the heart, for example, of the fight between Israel and Lebanon or Israel and Egypt historically has been access to water and control over water supplies. This, when you're thinking about, you wouldn't want to guarantee everybody water, think what we would save if we could try to guarantee fair distribution of water so that some of these world conflicts that suck up our resources, suck up our people, we pay for in blood, could be avoided. I mean, certainly talk to people in the Middle East. I remember going to Lebanon and they would describe how water had been redirected mm-hmm. out of their aquifers to serve Israel. And this was one of the main points of contention with the Israelis. The same thing on the West Bank and Israel. The Palestinians say the issue here is water. They're irrigating the desert with our water. There are some issues where we need some global commitment to fairness, and I think this is one of them.
You know, it's interesting. People don't realize in this country that at one time in Southern California, water was like gold. Anybody see the movie Chinatown knows that whole scene was about, the whole plot of the movie was about the distribution and access to water in Los Angeles. This is not something we, again, take it for granted in the 21st century. When we turn on the spigot, it'll be there. Folks, I went through this yesterday. It is a heck of a thing to open that spigot and just to hear something rattling like somebody's, being strangled in your bathroom. You really have to pay attention to who. And I really think the city of Stockton ought to be applauded for the idea that there were people there that decided that the public should make the final decision about whether or not their system gets privatized. Because what ends up happening too, Laura, is that when you have privatized water and other privatized services, what's the first thing they do? They cut their human resources. They lay people off. You see situations where there were at one point 600 employees, 700 employees at United Water. This is in Atlanta, Georgia. They had a contract going back to 1988. Of course, they terminated the contract in January of 2003, but they had a 20-year contract, $428 million with United Water. This is a subsidiary of the French conglomerate Suez, and they're the same people that deliver my water here in the New York area. They mismanaged that system, cut the staff from 700 to 300, charged the city for services it never provided.
You also have this illusion, don't you, when it comes up over and over again that private companies can do it better than public companies. Well, over and over again, you find out it's not true. And with companies like this that are in and then they're out, they lose the contract, their investment is not in maintaining the equipment that produces the clean water. You don't see an improvement in the infrastructure in the same way that you do when it's publicly owned, or you should. It's simply not as cut and dried as people like to think. You know, the private companies can do it better than the public ones. Water is one example where it's been proven over and over again not to be true. It's a huge story, and I hope that it gets more attention than just World Water Day. Apparently what happened yesterday was the United Nations and governments all over the world are seeking to halve the number of people without access to safe drinking water and basic sanitation by 2015.
You know, that would be a great thing for the World Bank to commit to as one of their priorities. That's their job, to
alleviate
poverty.
Funny you should mention that. Funny you should mention the World Bank. Of course, they're pushing for privatization.
Yes, they are. We're going to talk about the guy that Bush wants to be the new head of the World Bank when we come back. It's 46 minutes past the hour, Air America Radio.
I'm the Reverend Al Sharpton, reminding you that listening to any radio show besides Morning's Edition is officially considered selling out to the man. So keep it tuned here to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour, Air America Radio. This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. Laura Flanders of the Laura Flanders Show, heard weekends here on Air America, 7 to 10 p.m., is our special guest co-host of the morning.
So now we're going to talk about the, oh, man, now that's my hint. It's the wolf.
It's the wolf.
The wolf. There you have it. That wasn't bad. I was pretty close.
Yeah.
Do you think
good.
I was pretty close?
Yeah.
I do a good wolf impression.
Yeah.
Do you think he's going to go and meet with the Europeans in Brussels before this decision gets made next week about whether he gets to be head of World Bank?
I'm not sure if he's going to have to. It looks like the opposition to him is starting to crumble before our very eyes. Yesterday, German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder said he's not going to stand in the way. Now it looks like the Netherlands and Italy are both in his corner.
So what's happening?
I'm not sure. Did he go on some kind of a charm offensive?
I don't know. I haven't seen the cap-in-hand routine going on out there. Maybe he's just promising plain old money. But how can they trust this guy? I mean, two things about this. You know, I love how they call it the World Bank.
Yeah, right.
Hey, it's so not the World Bank, right? It's so obviously in this case, the U.S. gets the pick. The U.S. is in charge. Well, we give the most money. It's only right, said Dick Cheney today in the Washington Post interview. But this is a guy who has done nothing right when it comes to numbers, except right for his cause, I guess. Right for those who wanted to just go ahead with the policy no matter the cost. Remember how much he said it would cost the invasion and occupation of Iraq?
Was that the famed "not much" quote?
Well, he said $60 billion, and it would all be paid out of
oil
revenue.
Yeah,
yeah, and they still can't get the lights on, and they have less oil coming out of that place than they did in Saddam Hussein's day. We're looking at now what $300 billion, most of it for Iraq.
Yes,
and then he talked about, you know, the generals were wrong when they said it was going to take hundreds of thousands of troops. That was way off the mark. Well, we have 150,000 troops and still looking for more, and that's another story we'll probably talk about today.
Yes.
He was the one who went in front of Capitol Hill, and at a hearing, it was obvious he had no idea how many people had actually, how many U.S. combatants had actually died in Iraq. He said it was approximately 500 when it was over 700 at the time. I mean, this is a guy who cannot get anything right when it comes to numbers. He cannot get anything right when it comes to international relations. As far as the Middle East concerned and the Arab world, he flattened Iraq. What, now he gets to hand out the contracts to rebuild it and hand out contracts to his buddies? I mean, this stinks. And yet, as you just said, the Europeans are going along. I was hoping they were going to say, no way, Jose.
I get a sense, Laura, that the reason why they're going along has to do more with process than with Paul Wolfowitz. I think they're afraid that if there's too much overt and vocal European opposition to Wolfowitz, that America will pay the Europeans off on the back end the next time the president of the International Monetary Fund comes up, because Europe usually decides that.
And there are also smaller players, deputies and stuff that come in, and maybe they're cutting their deals there. But there's a lot going on with respect to the World Bank. There's a big fight over whether money should be distributed as grants or as loans.
Loans, yeah.
It's always political, and we were talking about this before the program, the pressure that the World Bank can put on countries like Venezuela and Uruguay and regimes that the White House doesn't like. It's a powerful stick to beat nations with. And, one of the only things that's been said for the World Bank in its favor in the last few years, as far as I'm concerned, is that we need some agency to put the brakes on business, to be some kind of oversight of corporate rule of the world. Mm-hmm. But Wolfowitz, buddy with Halliburton, Kellogg and Ranch and Root, I mean, these folks, this is not the man to be putting any kind of brakes on corporate world.
No, but you know what he can put the brakes on through his policies at the World Bank? The move, and it's been very subtle and out of view of most Americans, the subtle shift to the left in the governments of South America. And my guess is that if it, as we see it going on in South America, where Uruguay, and you've got, of course, Lula in Brazil, you've got Chavez in Venezuela, you've got these governments, and by the way, these are elected governments. These governments did not take power by coup d'etats. These are not military people, and of course, Brazil has a long history of that. But bottom line, we are seeing this subtle shift to the left. Now, that is not in total in terms of their economic policies. Their economic policies remain resolutely capitalist. But in terms of what they try to do for the poorest people in their countries, we're starting to see a lot of what I think some are describing, certainly the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in a piece that was there. You're talking about New Deal-type economies, trying to build these economies by building pathways of opportunity for the poorest people in many of these countries. Paul Wolfowitz and the World Bank can have a profound impact on different heads of government's ability to do that. Because if they start calling their loans, and remember now, most of these South American countries are indebted to on one level or another to the World Bank. If they start calling those loans, or if they start saying, you know what, you're going to have to institute a particular kind of policy where you're going to have to lay off large numbers of public employees, or you're going to have to do other kinds of draconian economic measures. This is the kind of thing that can spook an emerging movement. The South Americans are looking at the European model, the model of the European Union, and saying, why, oh, why can't I?
Mm.
Hugo Chavez in particular, who the United States detests, who the United States apparently was trying to back a coup attempt against, Hugo Chavez believes that the South American countries can form a union as powerful as the EU. He's even talked about a unified currency.
With oil.
With oil, yes.
They're also looking below them. I mean, they're looking to Argentina, they're looking Bolivia, they're looking Uruguay, they're looking Brazil, they're seeing Venezuela, they're saying...
Chile.
People get really pedo. They get really bugged when they can't get their kids into school, they can't get health care. Who are they going to obey? Are they going to obey the IMF that says privatize, privatize, privatize? Or are they going to listen to their people who say, if you try to impose these structural readjustment programs, we're going to get you out of office?
Yeah, it's an incredible thing to think about. You know, it's funny, Laura, I was in Washington last Thanksgiving and went by, it was the first time I had gone by the new headquarters of the World Bank this time, all glass, gorgeous, and there's a little vest pocket park right across the street from the World Bank where a huge contingent of D.C.'s homeless congregates. Paul Wolfowitz, you want to alleviate poverty? Start across the street from your office, okay, pal? We're going to take a break. We're coming across the top of the hour, and when we come back, we'll talk a little more about Paul Wolfowitz. We're going to talk about that very tragic shooting in Minnesota and some of the myths and legends that are growing around that. And later, we're also going to talk about Dave Habecker. He is the city council member of Estes Park, Colorado, who lost a very important vote yesterday. Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
It's 6 minutes past the hour. Good morning, my peeps. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation, and our special guest co-host, the host of the Laura Flanders Show, heard here on Air America weekends from 7 to 10 p.m., is Laura Flanders.
Do I have any peeps out there? Peeps.
Yeah, I know you got peeps.
Any weekend peeps listening in the morning?
We all got
peeps.
Hi,
happy morning.
Happy morning. Those of you who are struggling to get out of bed, wake up and do it. You gotta
do it eventually.
You gotta do it eventually. Oh, we did.
Yeah, really.
we had
to get up.
Absolutely.
That's cool, that morning get up, I'll tell you. Those evening shifts, you should try it, Mark. It's pretty fun.
Look, I used to love working nights. When I worked in the post office, this is a long time ago, but I worked from 5 p.m. to 1 a.m. It was perfect.
Perfect.
I would get out of work and go straight to parties. It was like wonderful. I was 19 years old. I was making decent money. You know what decent money was when I was 19 years old? Like about $8,000 a year. I mean, that was considered decent money. The rent was like maybe $80, $90 or whatever. Am I making myself sound like Ralph Cramden?
Okay. From the 50s? Back in the good old days.
In the good old days when nothing cost anything.
Get into the 21st century, Mark. Get into the 21st century. Let's talk about what's happened in Minnesota. This was an outrageous story, right?
It is an outrageous
this
story.
This kid, Jeff Weiss, I guess is how they're described, pronouncing his name, killed 9 people. Seems like it was him. There's nobody else in the story here, I have a suspicion. Then shot himself. It's taken place in this very remote part of Minnesota, very northern part of the state, the Red Lake Chippewa Reservation, 75 miles south, something like that, of the Canadian border. It's a fascinating story because of the parallels with Columbine, but also the differences. Here's a situation where a very poor school, 40% of the reservation are unemployed, live below the poverty line. 300 students at this school, the Red Lake High, scored second lowest of all the Minnesota schools last year on tests for 11th grade math and lowest for 10th grade. This is a place that clearly needs more attention. And this is an opportunity for us to take a look at the reservation and life on the reservation. And I know you've been up there, and we've both talked about how little attention these communities get. And I think it comes back down to attention. I mean, this is a kid who clearly had a troubled life. His father committed suicide.
His mother was injured in a car accident.
And in the hospital with brain damage. He's living with his grandfather.
No, grandmother.
His grandmother.
It was grandmother, and then that's why he went. Well, that's not why, but he went to his grandfather's house. And shot his grandfather and his companion.
And meanwhile, he'd been putting posts up on a Nazi website.
So
whenever I see these stories, I think, no kid lives in an island. No kid lives in total isolation. And when it comes to school violence or any other kind of violence, usually there are signs that precede any kind of outbreak. Where were the signs? Where were people watching over this kid? And you know what I'm afraid of is that we will, instead of having any of these questions answered about, this sometimes can be the cost that we pay for cutting back social programs, overstressing schools, overstressing teachers, that they can't watch and care for people who are in trouble. Instead of those kind of questions, which I think are the interesting ones, and I'm sure that we'll be talking about them a lot on Air America, we're going to get all the same stuff we got at Columbine. The schools are scary. Your kids could be shot. Columbine, the media gave us schools are a scary place night after night after night. Mm. It was grunge rock that was to blame. It was kids in trench coats that were going to kill people. In fact, schools are safer than they've ever been. There's less violence in schools than there's been for years. You're way more likely, if you're a kid, to be in trouble at home, get into conflict with your neighbors, your family members, be subject to abuse by family members. I mean, as usual, the story in the family is a place that's where most of the trouble happens, and yet these kinds of stories get us looking for, the crazy at school that could get your kids and the sad shape our kids, particularly our public school kids are in. It's often nothing to do with the truth.
You know what we're looking for, Laura? I hate to say this. We're looking for easy answers, and there are no easy answers. We have the Chippewa Reservation in Red Lake, Minnesota, in a great deal of pain. And I have to say, I have been to the Ogallala Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. And one of the things that you really, certainly people that live in urban or suburban areas, really have difficulty understanding about living on a reservation is that everything is so far spread out,
right,
and that people are so poor that normal means of transportation and these kinds of modalities simply don't exist. I remember being absolutely shocked that there were people, because we were working with a radio station that a friend of ours here here in New York had helped start on the Lakota Reservation in South Dakota. And one of the things that just struck me was there was a volunteer who would hitchhike 35 miles each way to get to the radio station each and every day of the week, because the person was very obviously dedicated, but they also had no car, they had no job other than the working at the station, and had no real means of survival. And you end up with situations of dependency, et cetera. But the thing that struck me, Laura, and the thing that I'm curious about, and we're going to find out more information on this in terms of Red Lake, one of the things that I think the reservations need are their own means of communication, radio stations, outlets that allow these folks that are spread apart. I mean, I forgot how many 100,000 acres there are on this particular reservation, but there are only 5,000 people. Well, you can get a real, true sense of isolation if you don't come in contact with them. If your nearest neighbor is 18 miles away, you see people maybe 2-3 times a week. And it makes for different kinds of relationships that, again, we in urban and suburban environments really have no concept of. And that radio or some form of communication.
Well, there is a growing native radio movement, and there are native stations all across the country that are trying to fill that gap. But you're right, I mean, it points to another problem. Kids are way more likely to get in trouble with drugs or drunk driving. You're more likely to die on those roads that you just described than you ever are likely to be shot in school. And it's something important to be reminded of in this period where we're going to get a lot of coverage of this story. And I'm afraid that a lot of it is not going to be very illuminating or very close to the facts. One of the things, though, you talked about how poor the reservations are. Let's not forget, these are Native American tribes that wouldn't be this poor if it wasn't for the federal government bilking them of billions of dollars that they're owed through the Indian Trust Fund. And it was just this year, again, for, I don't know, the umpteenth time, the courts have called the Interior, Department of the Interior, that's supposed to manage the Indian Trust Fund, have called them in violation of the law, have called them breaking the very most basic laws of their office. Gail Norton has a lot to answer for. Here's somebody who believes in, you know, let's let public parks be ruled by private corporations, but will she let Native American tribes get their hands on their own money that they're owed by this government for 100 years? No, you wouldn't see that kind of poverty if they were getting what they would do.
You're absolutely right. We're going to take a very quick break. It's 13 minutes past the hour. This is Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Past the hour. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is off today. He'll be back next Monday. Laura Flanders, host of the Laura Flanders Show on Air America Radio weekends, 7 to 10 p.m., is our special guest co-host. We're talking about the Jeffrey Weiss case in Minnesota and the larger context, Laura, of the issue of gun violence in this country generally. It's not just kids. It's not just on Indian reservations in Minnesota. And be sure, folks, about the fact that while we were discussing the poverty and some of the problems on the reservation, we are not excusing anyone's behavior when they decide to go on a murderous rampage based on those circumstances. We just think that those circumstances may have played a role in what took place at that particular school. Now, we also know from published reports that this kid was involved in some kind of Nazi or neo-Nazi behavior, posting on websites and apparently establishing a philosophy that despite the fact that he was Native American, he found common cause with the Nazis, Laura.
It's a fascinating part of the story, and I think it gets back to the question of monitoring, because here is somebody who was posting things on this website talking about, you know, racial purity and how he was under some illusion that the Nazi group that he was posting with would be sympathetic to his concerns, that apparently he was writing stuff about how his schoolmates on the reservation were, well, you said it earlier, were getting too into black culture, you know, and he felt like, well, I don't know what he felt, but he wrote about how he felt that the sort of Nazi ethic might work for him. I don't know. I mean, again, I think the question of lack of resources, lack of activities for kids after school, lack of oversight, lack of time on the part of, well, he didn't have parents that were in his life on a daily basis. He didn't have school teachers who were anything but utterly stressed. I mean, this is where the poverty piece comes in. No one's saying, you know, you're poor, there's any excuse for going and shooting people. But when you have that kind of stress in your life, there are very few people to turn to for help when your community is that under-resourced. Where are you going to go? And who's going to have time for you? I think that's what we're talking about when we talk about the economic context in which this happens. And again, I just don't believe these actions happen in a vacuum.
No, absolutely not. And it, you know, when you talk about where you're going to turn to get help, how are you going to get to the help? These reservations are spread out over hundreds of thousands of acres. It is not an easy trek for someone to go from their home to somewhere, because there are some community centers that have been built over time, but it's just difficult to access them. It certainly must have been difficult for a 16-year-old
kid. Well, I'm really interested to know what we're going to, the media are making their decision right now. People in the media are making their decision right now. How much they're going to cover this versus the Schiavo case, how much, what kind of attention they're going to give this story from Minnesota. I'd be curious to know what Air America radio listeners want to know about this story, and also whether you, the listeners, see connections between the different killings, the different shootings that you've just mentioned, Mark, and whether we learn anything from Columbine that you think we should be applying to this situation. The number is 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-AAR0. What do you want to know? Like, if you were in charge of a media team today, would you be covering this story? How would you be covering it? What context would you be putting it in? You know, I really think after Columbine, and we saw in the Michael Moore movie, Bowling for Columbine, the media coverage didn't help us get to the bottom of that at all.
Oh, not one bit. And you see this kind of violence, not just with kids. You see in February, a husband walking into a court in Tyler, Texas, kills his ex-wife and a bystander with an AK-47. The Chicago judge who came home and found her husband and mother shot dead. In March, there was a defendant, obviously, the Nichols case in Atlanta. You have all of these different multiple death shootings. And some people believe that it speaks to America's love affair and most Americans' easy access to guns and other kinds of weapons. But do people in our audience see any other connection in all of these killings?
I remember Michael Moore in Bowling for Columbine made the link between sort of our military culture and the culture in the schools. And, you know, we basically found out this weekend that the new National Defense Policy Statement is shoot first, ask questions later. Preemptive strikes are now a standard piece of our military, quote-unquote, defense policy. How shooting first can be a defense policy, I'm not sure. It sounds like an offense, you know, an offense policy. But this is context, too. And I don't know, if you think liberals are crazy to be linking that kind of stuff to what's happening in our schools, I'd love to hear. And I'd love to hear if you think there's a link there. 866-303-2270. I think there's a connection.
I do, too. I really think that when you begin to encourage the kind of preemptive warfare that we've seen America pursue in Iraq, you give license to people to think that that's the way you can settle your own personal problems. Why not? And you see folks walking into courthouses. You see folks in situations where, over time, people had thought, well, you have respect for judges. You have respect for this one. But no. And it's not just Jeffrey Weiss. It's people all over America. And it does speak to the easy access to guns. You know, there was an arrest here, a series of arrests here in New York recently, Laura, where people disrupted a gun procurement network, where people were just selling off AK-47s, but selling off Kalashnikovs, selling off all this sophisticated weaponry to anybody that could pay for them. This is incredible stuff.
Let's get some calls.
Yes, let us go first to Joan, who is calling us from Great Neck, Long Island. Joan, good morning.
Good morning. I'm on my way to work. I'm a teacher. And I think it's a disgrace that they've cut so many programs, and they're cutting educational programs, which could help these children.
And what kind of educational programs have they cut where you are?
Well, I'm in the city schools. And
enough said.
Okay, but you know what? We have a program where we have counselors called Baptist counselors that talk about drugs and smoking and all the terrible things that children do and how children react with one another. And they're thinking of cutting the budget and cutting these really very wonderful counselors out of the school.
Do you think counselors like that, Joan, in this situation might have been able to make a difference?
I think so. I absolutely think so. And I also agree with you with the assault weapons. It's a disgrace that they allow assault weapons, you know, on the streets. That's another problem.
It's a very big problem, and it might be a problem we can lay squarely at the feet of an organization called the National Rifle Association. Joe, thank you very much for the phone call. But, you know, they're never going to take the weight for that.
Well, no.
Not ever.
I mean, let's face it. This is an administration that wants to fight terrorism around the world with, you know, airplane bombing from 2,000 feet, but they don't actually want to stop anyone being able to get access to AK-47s and buy them on the streets of this country. So you got the contradiction right there.
It's an incredible contradiction. Let's go next to Pat, who's calling us from Atlanta. Pat, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. I just want to make a comment. I think it has to do with No Child Left Behind.
Oh, now explain that one.
Yeah.
Well, it's my understanding with the school budgeting system that all of these programs, if a school is failing, they just pull out more money. Here's a child that obviously needed attention. I understand he was being school in something called Homebound. Could the school system not have taken care of that? Could they have not have put him back into the school system where he would have gotten attention? I don't think he would have gone into the loner mode. If you're surrounded by people, it's real hard to be in a loner mode. And with Bush's budget, even this year, he's pulling more and more money out of public schooling.
Yeah, you're right, and they're doing it in a very insidious way in terms of saying, Laura, that, you know, schools that are failing should no longer exist, and what they start doing is systematically defunding those schools instead of really looking to try and improve them. And we know here in New York that No Child Left Behind has created chaos where people think that they can transfer their kids into better schools, but there's no room in
yeah.
the better schools.
And the money they get for it is nowhere near enough. I mean, it also goes back to teachers being totally focused on the testing. It's hard to keep your eye out for the quality of life of the kids. It's true. Apparently, Mr. Weiss was ordered to study temporarily at home because of a disciplinary problem. I mean, there you have it. The schools can't deal with it. They send the kids home. In this case, his home couldn't deal with it. You're right. I mean, I don't want to blame one piece of legislation, but the pressure on our public school systems these days is
intense,
but it still doesn't mean schools are more dangerous than homes.
No.
Typically, they're not.
And, you know, the sad part is kids aren't getting a better education either. We're going to take some more calls after the break. Those of you holding on, please stay with us. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Join the Morning Sedition right now. Call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Four past the hour. Good morning. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley, along with Ms. Laura Flanders, host of the Laura Flanders Show weekends here on Air America Radio. And, of course, Jonathan Larson is here with us, as well as Chris Lopresto, who's feeling a little under the weather, but the man is a trooper. He's on the set. He's on the case. And, Laura, we're going to go back to our phones at 866-303-2270. Some people are comparing this situation with Jeffrey Weiss to the Terri Schiavo case. Now, I'm not quite sure why, but we have a caller on the line.
Let's find out.
Let's say good morning to Chris, who's calling us from Florida. Chris, how you doing?
Good, and you?
Good. What's on your mind?
Okay. I was responding to the comment that about Terri Schiavo should be on the news more than the American Indian story. That's what I was saying, that she should have more news time than the American Indian story.
You don't think she's getting more news time than the American Indian story?
You're getting what you want so far, Chris.
Well, I understand that, but what I'm saying is that's the way it needs to remain because the government is supporting her being killed, whereas the American Indian was disgruntled. He's a neo-Nazi, and he went in and shot a whole bunch of people in the school. It has nothing to do with government policies.
Well, news doesn't only consist of government policies, does it?
Well, what I'm saying is because the American Indian is, the American Indians, a lot of them are poor alcoholics, whereas Terri Schiavo.
How many of them are alcoholics? You sound like you noticed from some personal experience.
There's a lot of alcoholism and drug use with the American Indian culture.
Yeah, there's a lot of drug use in Congress, too, but we don't hear about that. I mean, I think the guy's got a point. That you need, when you're a news director, and when the question was out there, you know, how would you prioritize the news items of today? Sure, the issues that have to do with government policy should be the top issues. I say, let's talk about this national defense policy of shoot first, ask questions later, the first strike policy. That is really the kind of story I'd like to see more attention go to. But, I mean, Chris has got a point with respect to Schiavo and the Indian One story has to do with an individual, one has to do with government intervention. I suspect, Chris, and you and I, Mark, might disagree on what is the kind of important message to be taken from
yes.
the Schiavo story. I would say, you know, here you have to question, what do you mean by government? I mean, you've had court after court after court after court make a decision. This isn't a question of government killing anybody. This has been litigated for more than a decade. This is a very carefully thought out case. With respect to the Weiss story, here's an opportunity to talk a little, at least I hope, about what's happening in some of the poorest parts of this country and what kind of a price we're paying in the lives of our children.
I just hope hope that they don't decide to have a congressional hearing on the Weese case. You know, the two biggest stories of the 109th Congress thus far, Laura, are the Schiavo case and the steroids hearings. They've been, you know, they've been dealt with all kinds of other policy. Most people don't know about that. Schiavo and steroids. Those are the two things that people pay attention to. And that is a function, unfortunately, of the priorities of media.
And that was another example, the steroid story. How did they get away with that, having it be only about the individual baseball players and kind of skipping the owners like George W. Bush? I mean, didn't Jose Canseco, wasn't his story that he was giving the steroids to people at the Rangers while W. was part owner of the team?
Yes.
Somehow W. was absent from that whole story, that whole set of hearings, never got to really the responsibility of the owners. Another example, we like to cover the individual, the personalities, the bit players in the picture, and not look at the big story.
Yeah,
the big
context. Picture.
Let's take some more calls. There's Amy calling in from Minnesota. Amy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Amy.
Amy, are you with us?
No, actually, I think, wait a minute, here we go.
Amy, are you there?
Hi, Amy.
The local news has pointed out a lot of things. Number one, that child was raised in the Twin Cities, taken away from the relatives he knew here when his mother was put in a nursing home after his father had committed suicide. All of it there at a tender age of 11, this happened to him. He was then sent up way up north onto a reservation. This is a child that they describe in the Twin Cities as being calm, quiet, caring, loving. But they said he got hooked up into a system where he had no say on what happened to him. And when he got up there, he was tormented and teased for years, and this is the second school shooting we've had in this state. And the uniform factor is not the economic circumstances of the children necessarily. The overriding factor is these are children that have been, where school districts have tolerated the groups that bully. And we now have institutionalized bullying as an American trait with this president.
Now, Amy, you're absolutely right about the institutionalized bullying aspect, but isn't there a piece of this picture that does have to do with the economic condition, if not of the kids, then of the school?
I think it has to do with school funding. When we have Minnesota ranks very low in the number of counselors to students. We have a ratio of 1 to 400.
Which means, by the way, that one school would only have had one counselor since there were only 300 kids in the school.
I don't even know because it was a reservation school, so I don't know how that school is even funded. But the issue is, you know, we are not, as long as we tell students that are being bullied that the problem is them to figure out coping skills instead of sending the bullies to the principal's office.
That's right.
We are going to continue to have kids that feel they're backed into a corner with no one supporting them.
You know, it's interesting. We talked about this issue. And, Amy, thank you very much for your call. We talked about this issue a couple of weeks ago when Mark was here about bullying both in schools and, you know, in daily life. And it does leave a mark that I think both the bully and the bullied have no clue about when they're young, but those scars remain.
Were you ever bullied, Mark?
Not really. I had good verbal skills. You know, when you're bullied, when you know, there were people. See, unfortunately, I was a bully to my. I can admit it now. I was a bully to my younger brother. I really was. I made him clean up our room. I made him wash dishes. I made him do all of that kind of stuff under threat of violence. That's what I would. But I stopped doing that when I was 10.
You were a bully, Mark. You were clearly a bully.
No,
inside
I stopped doing
the family.
I stopped doing that. You know what happened? I had older cousins who, when they came to family gatherings, I became the bullied. You know, because they were all tight with my younger brother, so they all got together and picked on me for
the
day.
The amazing thing about bullying is it really does make kids take sides. I mean, I was lucky enough not to be bullied, but I sure do remember, and I still feel bad about the kids that I watched be bullied, and I never did anything.
Yeah.
Because you're put in that situation where you feel like, well, if you don't want to be the bullied, you better not take it, you know, better not intervene. We've got to figure out how to deal with this as a society, because I think that's where we are now in politics. We have, you know, an administration out of the White House running roughshod over our rights, and you have a media that are acting like kids watching bullies in the play yard, and they don't want to intervene in case the anger, the aggro gets directed their way. I think bullying gets to the heart of a lot of things, and Amy, I appreciate your call. One counselor for 400 kids, this is not going to get us anywhere.
Not much. Let's go next to Steve, who's calling us from Madison, Wisconsin. Steve, good morning.
How you doing there, Mark?
All right, how you doing?
I'm doing all right, and how you doing there, Miss Flanders?
Oh, it's great to be here. Steve,
well,
great to have you.
I'll tell you, I'm real pissed off right now listening to Chris talk about what he said about our poor young guy Weiss there in Minnesota. I'm from Madison, Wisconsin, and I'm relatively close to that area. I've got a real good friend who's a Native American, and I can tell you there is no race that exists in this country that's more disenfranchised than the Native American itself.
That's
you know,
right.
And when I see I said just yesterday when I saw this Terry, the story about Terry being thrown in front of us,
Terry Schiavo, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we all paid attention to it, and we couldn't help but do it because it's an awful situation. But here we're talking about a white woman, all right? And here we have, once again, a Native American who loses his mind out of disenfranchisement, as Amy said. He's from the Twin Cities. He got moved into a place just the way his nation did. And it is a nation, not a tribe, and that's the way people will talk about them, the tribe. But they prefer to be called nation,
mm-hmm.
He once again became disenfranchised, and everything is going to be made about all the websites that he visited. But I'm certain he's not the first Native American who acted in anger. And yet what we have is one white woman who, wants to die, who can't. And now we've got a Native American who's so angry that all he can see is death. And I'm really angry about this.
It's amazing that you put it in that context, Steve, because what I predict is going to happen in the Schiavo case is that we're now going to get a Terry Schiavo death watch that's going to last, as far as the media is concerned, at least into next week. And the media is going to facilitate and enable the Congress of the United States to make political hay even more than they have up until now out of this entire process because they feel shut out.
Oh, sure, sure. They're going to drag this out until she's dead to have the smoke screen up, And I don't say that to disrespect her because I feel really bad for her and her husband who's been painted as Scott Peterson,
I know. Isn't that amazing?
Lifers.
That's amazing. You put it in a very interesting context, the idea that they have demonized this guy. The guy has, he's got a woman that he lives with. He's got two children with that woman. But, again, he has been – he didn't appoint himself Terry Schiavo's guardian. He was appointed Terry Schiavo's guardian.
In fact, he's the second biggest victim in this entire situation. All he did was try and live his life. He's turned down money to go ahead and put the feeding tube back in, and yet he's Scott Peterson in the eyes of the rest of it, in deference to Mark Maron, the neocon death cult.
Good work. Steve, thanks a lot for calling, man. Appreciate it.
And it's coming from the very same people that go on about the sanctity of marriage. It really makes me crazy. On the one hand, nothing should come between a man and his wife, a wife and her husband. And in another, in this case, the guy's just a crook and we need to go with the parents. Let's pick somebody else to be on the side of.
Yeah, absolutely. We are going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, we're going to tell you about the outcome of a very interesting and, I think, for a lot of people, troubling case involving the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. Stay with us. This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition,
the highest rated, most respected news show in America
on Air America Radio.
Coming up on 50 past the hour, this is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. Laura Flanders, host of the Laura Flanders Show, heard here on Air America, is our very special guest co-host for the day. We're so glad to have her here with us. Laura, there's been some interesting things going on out west. Out at the gateway to the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah, a little place called Estes. It's an interesting story, and I know you've been covering it for a while, but
yes.
You know that constitution that we have, the right to free speech, freedom of religion, all of that stuff? Well, there's a guy who has been, he's basically run afoul of those who believe that unless you're willing to say under God in the pledge, you have no right in government.
That's right, in the Pledge of Allegiance. Now, this story started last May when the council or the town church trust, I guess it's the town board, town governing board.
Trustees.
Yeah, trustees. Decided at the behest of one trustee to begin reciting the Pledge of Allegiance to show that they had respect for the country during wartime. And our guest, who is on our telephones, we've had him on before, town trustee David Habecker, at a point refused to do that, and now he has been made to pay the price. David Habecker, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Now, the town of Estes Park voted, I guess, by a 3-2 margin to remove you after 12 years in office?
12 years on and off, yes.
Incredible. Were you surprised at the vote, which was 903 in favor of removing you to 605 in favor of keeping you?
Not really.
No, why not?
I was, I guess, optimistic going in. I'm always optimistic. But it's an inflammatory issue, especially when the opposition was telling people that I turned my back to the flag, which was a blatant lie. But it inflames people.
Well, tell us exactly what happened.
After it had been recited, at a few meetings, I just couldn't do it. I conscientiously object to the term under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. And I would stand and, not say the words, but it's hypocritical to do such a thing. And myself and other constituents of mine who are, like feeling people, are faced with that dilemma every time they come to a board meeting that they have to acknowledge a God that they do not believe in.
Tell us a little bit about the political makeup of Estes Park there and the economics of all of this. I mean, you're still in tourist season. Is this really how the town wants to be spending its money?
Talk to the people who brought the recall petition to say whether or not they want to, have the town spend the money on this. Actually, our tour season starts in the summer. We are not a winter destination as most others are in Colorado. But the political makeup, it's mostly, I guess the majority is Republican. The Democrats have very seldom won anything up here, although the town board members do not run on a party affiliation.
Mm-hmm. David Habecker, did people notice at first, your colleagues on the governing board, did they notice when you didn't say the words under God? Was there any reaction to that, or was it only a reaction when you decided not to stand up?
I don't know that anybody could hear whether or not I said the words or not. There's only really one other trustee next to me who would have heard it, and she's shorter than I am, so I'd be talking over the top of her. So nobody noticed, and that wasn't really the issue. The issue is I just couldn't do it.
Mm.
Just one meeting, I just sat there, and my legs wouldn't pick me up. I couldn't do it.
So who is really behind this push to have you be recalled for your seat?
There's several. One of the trustees, the one that originally thought of the idea, thinking it was a great idea, she told the board how upset she was with me and my position and all, and wanted to have her vote back. And then her husband came down and berated me and said that he was going to start a recall petition, and he and a few other folks in town got the necessary number of signatures on a petition that you need to call for a recall.
Now, how many was that?
214 was the required number of vote signatures.
So it didn't take very much. And yesterday was the voting, and you came out the loser in this. What happens next?
Well, I don't consider myself the loser. I have been recalled. That's all that happened. What was the rest of your question?
Well, what do you do next? Where do you go?
Well, this is one battle. I have already filed suit in federal court. Against the whole process and the fact that my First Amendment rights are being violated. There's also our state constitution is even more specific, saying that I cannot be denied my political capacity because of my religious beliefs.
Now, will your seat on the board remain vacant, or will there be a special election? And if so, when will it happen?
At the same time of the recall, there was a list of four people who had filed petitions to run for the vacant seat, if in fact it should happen. So we have already elected my replacement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that replacement, I assume, is prepared to stand during the pledge.
Oh yeah, he is a professed believer.
Mm, so that's what he ran on. Are you against religion, David Haybacker?
Absolutely not. Most of my family are religious. I've been a religious person. Everybody is supposed to be able to believe in their own way. But heaven help the person that decides to do it differently.
It really makes you wonder. I mean, listening to David's story here, there's often been a question, do you think an out atheist, as it were, could ever run for president? I'm afraid David's story suggests like he'd have a really tough time.
I knew when I sat that my political days were over.
Are you going to remain active politically even though you're not on the council anymore?
Oh, yes. And maybe even more so. When I think people's rights are being violated, I don't hesitate to step forward.
David Haybacker, is there anything that people can do if they're listening in the Colorado area, maybe want to make a trip to Estes Park and express themselves? Anything you're encouraging?
I hope people don't deny themselves the pleasure of visiting the Rocky Mountains because of this issue. And I, on the other hand, too, I hope that people don't, come here because of it. But, no.
we'll catch up with you when you figure out something.
Yeah. It
would be nice if people would say something about freedom of religion and freedom from religion, right?
I hope that that this whole thing has caused people to think about what tolerance means.
Definitely. David Haybacker, thank you so much for being with us.
You betcha.
We appreciate it. David Haybacker, former councilman.
What a story. What a story. You know, it starts in these little places, little story, and then you suddenly realize, wow, we have a loyalty oath.
Yeah. We're going to come right back. We're going to give you the latest on the Terri Schiavo case. And Congressman Jerry Nadler joins us in the next hour of Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Six minutes past the hour. Good morning. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is out of town. He's on vacation, and he needed one, and he deserved one, and he'll be back next Monday. So those of you who are conspiracy theorists and have been, waking up this morning and saying to yourself, wait a minute, where is that Mark Maron? He's not here. He'll be back on Monday. And we are pleased to have with us as our special guest co-host, Ms. Laura Flanders.
I'm here, Laura Flanders here. Instead of they let me out not on the weekends. Isn't that fun?
Yeah. Now, you do the Laura Flanders Show, 7 to 10 p.m. And she does the same kind of seditious radio that we do here.
Evening Sedition, we call it.
Yes, Evening Sedition.
We thought it was an original title.
Laura, how you doing?
I'm doing well. This has been quite a week of news. You know, last week there was all sorts of big news about the budget, about Wolfowitz, about, the national defense policy. What did we get? We got baseball, steroids, Peterson, Jackson. Mm-hmm. This week, same thing, huge news, second anniversary of the U.S. invasion occupation of Iraq. What are we talking about? Terri Schiavo. Huge news, Tom DeLay's scandal, his whole empire is built on fraud and corruption. What do we get? Terri Schiavo. No wonder this guy, Tom DeLay, was so excited and happy when the Terri Schiavo story came along.
Yeah, he sure did seem to be a little like it was some sort of godsend, not to defame or blaspheme the man on high.
Wait, he said as much. He said one thing that God brought to us is Terri Schiavo. So you're not going out on a limb there.
Now, for those of you who are just waking up and don't know this yet, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, based in Atlanta, ruled 2-1 that Terri Schiavo's feeding tube should remain out of her body. In other words, they rejected the parents' request that the feeding tube be continued. This is, of course, in accordance with the wishes of her husband, Michael, who, as one of our callers said, has been portrayed as Scott Peterson or something. but this case is generating an extraordinary amount of heat. We had a caller who decided to do story triage and say that the Schiavo story was more important than the story out in Minnesota. This young man who killed nine people. I just find it amazing that folks would want to do that kind of triage about the news of the day. But it's done every day, unfortunately.
It's also a huge story in media circles and in the Beltway, and it's clearly a big story on politicians' minds. But if you look at the polls, clearly Americans, majority of them, 63% according to ABC, support the removing of the feeding tube because they've been in this situation or their families have been in this situation. Sure, this particular case has been litigated more than any other case of its kind because there's a dispute between the husband and the parents of this poor woman. I wrote in a column this week, you know, what about her? Who is actually thinking about her? And I think that a lot of families find themselves in this situation and try to keep their focus on the loved one who is now in this state where they can't make decisions for themselves. And in this case, her husband says she had expressed her wishes to him that she didn't want to live this way. A lot of people have been there. And according to the polls, as I said, 63% support the removal of this tube. 67% think this is all just about politics, and that's what Tom DeLay is doing. So here is a fascinating story where the media is eaten up in a dispute, where if you actually look at the population's pretty decided. Not that heated on this story.
Yeah, you know, you're right, and it's amazing to me that there are so many political contradictions. We talked about some of them before the break, but one of the biggest is the notion that in George W. Bush's home state of Texas, he signed a bill that gave not family, but a hospital the decision as to whether or not to remove someone, not from a feeding tube, but from life support. 1 6-month-old black child in Texas is already dead, and another guy, a 68-year-old man who had been on life support, was almost left to die. And the question is not just how you feel about that specific issue, but how the Bush administration can reconcile, on the one hand, saying Terry Schiavo should live, but on the other hand, having signed a law in the books that allows corporate America to decide who lives and who dies.
Yeah, and it's a big difference, I think, because you're right. In the Texas case, and this was apparently fine with the National Right to Life Committee and fine with George W., who was governor at the time, if the patient can no longer pay for their medical expenses and more care would be futile, those are the two things it needs for the hospital to refuse or to decide that the feeding, that the life support can be cut off. So economics plays a role in that. I think that's more more controversial than anything we're seeing in Florida. The other interesting thing about the Texas story is that, George W. Bush signed that law. What changed? What's the difference here? And, you know, let's not forget, this is an administration that on the one hand is talking about culture of life, and on the other hand is cutting back health care for the poor, Medicaid for people with disabilities. I mean, they may not like to talk about removing a feeding tube, but that's what their budget's doing. It's removing a feeding tube for people who need social services today.
Yeah.
Are we going to watch them dying slowly close up on TV? I don't think so. I mean, the other piece of this story is the use of the media. In the Texas case, the hospitals have the right and have routinely said no video. We're not letting any film out of these patients because that would be a violation of their privacy. In this case, this is a story being driven by video images. And there are video images that are inevitably manipulative.
They were
gathered for a lawsuit by people with an interest. Apparently, as what I've read is they kept a camera rolling in her room for 8 hours, found some involuntary movements that they managed to make look as if they were responding to things. This is incredibly manipulative, and the TV producers, I think, have a responsibility. Every time they put that tape on, they are playing a piece that, you know, they're taking a side in this story, in a sense, because the science that the medical know-how is, well, it's been decided over and over again in the courts that there is no ability to respond.
You know what's amazing about this? In the case of Son Hudson, the 6-month-old child who was taken off life support in Texas, his mother did want to film him because she also had an issue with the decision that he was vegetative and had no hope of recovery. She said he was showing signs of life. She was not allowed to videotape him. And in fact, you'd have to wonder, based on this, why someone would say that Son Hudson's mother, had no right to say that her child maybe could have lived under certain circumstances. But people are paying such close attention to Terry Schiavo's parents, who are saying essentially the same thing.
Yeah, it begins to feel like those prepackaged news releases, you know, those video news releases that show just one side of the story. It's hard to give a video, a very moving video news release of the doctor's testimony explaining what's in her cerebral cortex and what isn't. And let's not forget, I mean, this is a tragedy we're talking about. And the whole politicization situation of this struggle, this situation, has put people in the situation of taking sides. And we can all sympathize with these parents.
Yes.
No question. But I have to say, you know, when the mother, who hasn't been speaking to the media this much, but did talk on Saturday, said, you know, she's my life, I heard in that moment the problem here, that Terri Schiavo has become about other people's lives. She is so important for Tom DeLay's Congress, for the mother's continued, you know, sense of self, for the courts, for these right-wing, you know, posturers in Congress today.
That's just what they are, too.
And what we've forgotten is her.
Yeah.
What we've forgotten is actually her suffering. That's at the heart of this. I think we've kind of lost the empathy muscle in this country.
Yeah.
And this is just another example of it.
You know, it's going to be interesting. Tom DeLay's Congress has decided to insert itself into this. And there are a lot of people who are speculating as to why. When we come back, we're going to play you a piece of Tom DeLay himself explaining why. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on the air. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
Huh? Blah, 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 blah. That's right. 19 minutes past the hour. This is Air America Radio's Morning's Edition. And I played the blah, blah, blahs, not because of our guest co-host.
Yeah, I was wondering.
Not because of me, but because of the guy that we're about to introduce. Because that's exactly what he does.
Blah, 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 blah.
And you know who we're going to play some tape of? Well, let me set it up.
Set it up. Set it up, Mark.
The end of last week, House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, you know, who, when he's not busy arranging for steroid things or, you know, talking about, you know, how wonderful everything conservative, in fact, is, or when he's not out shilling for Bush's Social Security privatization or any of the other stuff he's busy doing, he finds time to speak to the base. He finds time to speak to people like the Family Resource Council. Is it council or center?
Council.
Council. Family Resource Council.
Research.
I'm sorry. Family Research Council. Now, this is organizations headed by one Tony Perkins.
That's right.
Not the same Tony Perkins that was in Psycho. Although,
it's not
that great a leap. No, let me tell you something. I was amazed last summer, Laura, when Tony Perkins said that his constituents in the Family Resource Council were more concerned with same-sex marriage than they were with bread-and-butter pocketbook issues in this country.
They're not that concerned about marriage in the Schiavo case, are they?
Not that much. Not if it goes against their fundamental tenets or precepts. They can step all over the institution of marriage.
Bring us back, Mark. Bring us back to Tom DeLay when he's not out there gathering money illegally and giving money illegally. Went to speak with the Family Research Council, and what did he say?
Well, you know, he said some very interesting things about the Schiavo case, and I think this has really given fuel to people who think that there are folks that are well prepared to use this case for partisan political gain. Let's go to the House Majority Leader.
One thing that God has brought to us is Terri Schiavo to elevate the visibility of what's going on in America. That Americans would be so barbaric as to pull a feeding tube out of a person that is losing and starve them to death for 2 weeks. I mean, in America, that's going to happen if we don't win this fight.
And he went on to say, you know, that what's going on in the United States are attacks against the conservative movement, attacks against me, not me, Laura Flanders, me, Tom DeLay, and against many others. I mean, this is a guy who, as you say, he's going on a Friday. Now, this is the plan. They have a plan already for Palm Sunday that they're going to bring Congress back from parts all over the world, and George W., at enormous expense, I have to say, our expense, is going to fly back to Washington. Why couldn't he have signed any legislation in Texas? There was no reason for him to fly at our public expense back to Washington. Nonetheless, he has a plan, Tom DeLay, Friday night. He can see a story. He can smell a story that's good. good for him. That scandal, that ethics violation, talk about understatement scandal, is beginning to blow big. It's the second anniversary of the U.S. invasion, and killing and dying in Iraq is continuing. He has an idea what he can do this weekend. He goes to the Family Research Council to make a pitch to them. Luckily, there were folks there with a tape. But it wasn't just what was heard on that tape that came out this weekend that led 67% of Americans to believe this is about politics, not about human life. But also ABC News found a memo that was distributed unsigned to Republican members of the Senate. It has, the full text is actually there at the abcnews.com website. It describes the talking points. It's talking points on this Incapacitated Persons Legal Protection Act, which is the thing that Tom DeLay pushed through on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, they don't spell Terry Schiavo's name right in this. There's one R.
But hey, nobody's perfect.
Yeah, they have it with one R here. So the Senate needs to act this week, they say. This is an important moral issue, and the pro-life base will be excited that the Senate is debating this important issue. So they're saying it's important because our base will get excited. And then they go on to say this is a great political issue. Why? Because Senator Nelson of Florida, a Democrat, has already refused to become a co-sponsor, and this is a tough, tough issue for Democrats. Are you hearing Terry Schiavo in here? Are you hearing concern about her suffering? Are you hearing real concern about the parents or the brother or anybody else? This is about our pro-life basis GOPs, senators, and about trying to do in Senator Nelson of Florida.
Well, you know, they've gotten very little, the pro-life conservative people, the pro-life, anti-abortion, however you want to describe them, the anti-same-sex marriage, the whole conservative crowd. They have gotten nothing from this administration thus far. What have they gotten? A bankruptcy bill? Big deal. Arctic wildlife? I don't think so. They haven't been able to pass Social Security, not that it would help them any. So what have they gotten?
And you're never going to get that stuff either, because the GOP needs those issues to keep terrifying their poorer voters to come out and vote for them. They're never going to actually give away the store here. It's too darn valuable.
Well, Gene, I hope they don't up another terror alert or something. You know, when all else fails, go to Orange. I mean, it's really starting to scare me, quite frankly, Laura, that these folks, and you know, I keep waiting to see, is this the issue where they're going to overreach? Is this the issue where they're going to overreach? This case is such shameless hustling. Okay. Anybody that's ever spent any time around hustlers, and I've spent a couple of minutes
say,
around.
You know about shameless hustling. Right?
Well, I do know a little bit because I used to hang out during my misspent youth with some guys. That anybody that had been lived in the life knows exactly what the lay and these guys are up to, and it is about an agenda that has to do with them, not with Terry Schiavo. And the people, the conservative Christian right, who I may disagree with about what time of day it is, I feel bad for them because they're getting played like a Stradivarius right now.
Yeah, I mean, there was also Robert Novak on his blog talking about how the RNC had sent out a warning to the House of Representatives that the GOP is in danger of losing 25 seats in the 2006 election. Now, maybe that's just trying to scare them, but that's more example of what was really on the mind of Tom DeLay this weekend. I don't think it was Terry Schiavo.
No, it wasn't. And when we come back, you know, we're going to be talking after the break with Congressman Jerry Nadler, who has gone on record as opposing the bill that Congress passed over the weekend. And, of course, he's also gone on record as being opposed to the Social Security privatization scheme, which, by the way, has been percolating underneath the surface of all of this. You know, they got the steroids, they got the Schiavo, they got all these other things. But the Social Security thing has not been going all that great for George W. Bush. And he's trying with Zelig-like skill to try and you know, morph his proposal, which, by the way, he never put in any kind of concrete
terms. You have any idea what this proposal is at this point?
Nobody does. People are boxing in shadows.
The amazing thing, though, is they cannot alienate people from Social Security. It was such a good idea. It's so compassionate. It makes so much sense. It's so economically feasible and so economically efficient that with a little bit of figuring out, we can figure out how to make that Social Security trust fund viable for as long as we need it to be. And Bush, with his whole propaganda campaign, and Karen Hughes, the whole crew out there, they cannot alienate people from that program. It's such a good idea. Makes so much sense. So compassionate. Each generation looks after the generation that came before them. people are not going to be moved, and they're not being moved, and that's what Bush is finding out. Are we also going to talk about the rising of the age limit for recruits for the military? That's an important
story. Oh, yeah. Well, they raised it up, and that, of course, is because they're not getting as many people as they'd like.
Soon it'll be up there around about retirement age.
Well, it'll be around my age, and then I'm going to be in real, real trouble. You know, they were talking about drafting guys in their 70s, you know, people who were in particular specialties. Scary stuff. But when we come back, we're going to be talking live in studio with New York Congressman Gerald Nadler about Social Security, Shivo, and much, much more. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
It's 34 past the hour. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. Laura Flanders is our special guest co-host. We've got a guest with us in studio. But first, every week, we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the five-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. Here with today's dispatch from the War on Brains is war correspondent Mort Milvington.
Dateline, Pinellas Park, Florida. Site of the country's first orange grove, an origin of Anita Bryant's ironic hatred for anything considered fruity. The body human, a citadel of flesh, its defenses many. The epidermis, protecting your blood from harmful invading bacteria. The hypodermis, protecting your cell's delicate structure from physical injury. And the beverage thermos, protecting your coffee from the cold for those times you need to douse your neighbor's Pekingese with a hot cup of discipline. Shut your dog up, Fredo. Enter one Terry Schiavo, eating disorder victim. Yet another casualty of a selfish culture obsessed with instant gratification, cheap oil, and high-fructose corn syrup.
Ow.
For this is Bush's country, his Xanadu. Over the weekend, the Republican Congress, posing as Marcus Wellaby, rammed the unprecedented emergency legislation down the throat of an unwilling public. Its aim? To extend Tom DeLay's sad and diseased political life by allowing Schiavo's case to be reviewed by the federal courts. Evidently, in tribute to Schiavo's favorite Steelers quarterback, it was dubbed Terry's Law. Springing to action in order to prolong the kind of torture only Roman Catholic parents could get off on, our brave war president diverted his attention from important napping and tumbleweed-clearing reconnaissance to sign the legislation. Did he really think he could preserve another potential voter by forcing her to swallow the mean end of a whammo water weenie?
Oh, God.
Shameful, ignominious. But let's give the man some credit. Having experienced a persistent vegetative state for most of his life, President Bush knows better than most what Shivo's going through right now. After all, he did spend the bulk of his college career with a rubber tube down his throat. Of course, it was attached to a beer hat. But should a man who freely put to death two retarded kids and one small oil company really be lecturing us on the sanctity of life? And I ask you, where were you, Dick Cheney, while millions of American children are being poisoned with mercury, lead, and arsenic, making the knee of them even dumber than the Australians? Shouldn't you be fighting for tighter pollution controls? And you, Bill Frist, while millions of Americans are being denied adequate medical access, shouldn't you be fighting for universal health care? And where were you, Tom DeLay, when I was at death's door suffering from a rattlesnake bite? Shouldn't you have sucked the venom from my bruised and mangled penis?
Ooh.
Sure, it's an old bar joke, but jacuzzi! That's right, America. George Bush and his myrmidons won't be content until you're all condemned to lie in a hospital bed and listen helplessly to your lonely uncle go on and on about Scientology. Tell them, freedom fighters, make a living will and wear a helmet. And that's today's dispatch from
the War on Brains.
Thank you, Mort.
You're welcome. Sure, it's not the funniest subject.
No. As a matter of fact, our guest is on his way out the door, it seems. But no. Thank you so much.
Whatever.
Come back when you don't have to stay so long. Yeah, keep the light off for us.
Okay, so now for the seamless segue.
Yes. You want to do it?
Yeah, I was trying
to. Go ahead, Laura.
Live
dangerously.
Well, let's see. Congressman Jerry Nadler is fighting the war for a little bit of brains in Congress. Is that good? Is that a good
segue? That's a good segue.
That'll work, right? He represents New York's 8th District, as you know, and he was there this weekend voting against the initiative to retain the feeding tube in the Florida case. Jerry Nadler, welcome to the program, Congressman.
Good morning.
Good morning, Congressman. Thanks for being with us.
Why did you feel this law was dangerous? Was it just the medical part of the picture or the political constitutional piece that got you?
Well, it was both. I mean, first of all, Congress had no business intervening and to prolong the agony of this family. This has been going on for 15 years. The Florida courts have thoroughly adjudicated it. The medical testimony, uncontradicted. I mean, one of the things that really bothered me was these members of Congress making medical diagnoses based on a 5-year-old videotape. That's medical malpractice, frankly. But, of course, they want to get rid of malpractice lawsuits. But in any event, the uncontradicted medical testimony in court, which the court accepted, as a matter of fact, was that her cortex was liquefied. That means there is no cortex. Without a cortex, there's no feeling, there's no consciousness, there's no sensuousness, there's no pain, there's no feeling of any kind, there's nobody home. There may be a brainstem which continues breathing and autonomic nervous functions, but there's nothing that makes a human being a human being. And once that's true, effectively, you're dead, and you're never going to recover. Now, the parents have illusions. I mean, you know, they're deluding themselves, and your heart goes out to them, and you understand why. But there's no neocortex, number one. And number two, also the testimony was that she had, Terry Schiavo had told other people, her husband, her brother-in-law, sister-in-law, several friends, at funerals of people who'd been kept alive artificially before she had her heart attack, that, gee, if that ever happened to me, I wouldn't want this to be done. I wouldn't want to continue. So the court found, number one, that there was nothing there, that there was no cortex there, and number two, that this was her will, even though it wasn't in writing, and therefore ordered the tube removed. Now, why should Congress suddenly step into that? And what was offensive in a different way was, I mean, the rhetoric was that you had to let the federal courts adjudicate whether she was being deprived of life or liberty without due process of law by the state courts. But that had already been done.
Yeah,
she'd gotten due process. It had gone to the Supreme Court. And this bill said that the federal court should step in and should look at the case de novo, which means ignoring everything that had happened. So the doctors would have to come in and testify again, presumably. The witnesses as to what she said would have to come in and testify again. This could potentially prolong it by several years and to the same outcome because the court would find the same thing. So what was the point?
Well, what is the point, and where do we stand now? I mean,
I'm a little surprised at the court decision this morning.
Well, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
I mean, what happens at this point? You've got an appeal, a federal appeals court now also rejecting the parents' effort.
Well, apparently the courts reacted against Congress overstepping its bounds by, in effect, having total contempt for the Florida courts and saying that the federal court should ignore everything that happened in the Florida courts, and they didn't do that. The federal court below, that is the federal district court, to get an injunction and to put the feeding court tube back as an injunction, you have to show likelihood of success at a full trial.
Right.
So you put the tube back to keep the situation status quo so you can have a trial. And the judge said you'd be hard-pressed to show probable success in the merits. Now, he could only say that if he was giving some credence to the fact that these witnesses had testified as to what she had said and the doctors had testified as to what her health status was. So he wasn't completely ignoring the state courts, as the congressional legislation seems to have indicated he should. Now, maybe he would hold that federal legislation unconstitutional. He didn't go into it in detail. But in any event, he clearly didn't completely ignore the Florida courts, as he should not have, but as Congress probably intended that he should. And he dismissed it. He declined to grant the injunction. They appealed to the Federal Appeals Court, which this morning also declined to grant the injunction. And based solely on what I heard on the radio in the cab coming here, apparently did so on the same grounds of lack of likelihood of success on the merits. Now, they'll appeal to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court's already declined the other case twice. It'll probably do so again. The only thing that might prolong this is if Governor Bush manages to get the Florida Senate to change its mind and pass a bill that passed the Florida House last week, which would say that in a case where there's no living will, where there's no written living will, and where there is dissension in the family, you can't take out the feeding tube. Now, interestingly, this is, I mean, I find that this legislation also is contemptuous not only of the Florida courts and Florida legislature, but contemptuous of what the conservatives always talk about, the sanctity of the family, mm-hmm. the sanctity of marriage. Because what you're saying is we don't care what the husband says.
But, Congressman, you know, when you talk about contemptuous of the courts, it seems as though this entire sequence of decisions has unleashed a floodgate, some might say a wholesale assault on the court system. I mean, you've got Tom DeLay saying the courts are this and that. And the
other. There's been a wholesale assault on the court system going on for some time in Congress now, led by the Republican right wing, usually assailing unelected federal activist judges. Here they're assailing state judges, and let's give it to those untrustworthy activist federal judges who proved untrustworthy from their point of view yesterday and today. But this court, I mean, we passed legislation last year. I was one of the leaders of the opposition. Court stripping legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Passed it twice. We said no federal court shall have jurisdiction to consider the constitutionality of, fill in the blank, the two blanks were the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act and of the coerced recitation of the Pledge of Allegiance with the phrase under God in it. And I said on the floor that if you did that, this would become boilerplate language. And it did. This year, in the so-called Real ID Bill, which all the publicity of which was about whether you could tell states not to use, not to give ID driver's licenses to undocumented aliens. There was another provision. Because there's frustration on some people at some bureaucratic obstacles to building a fence along the border in San Diego.
Yes.
Instead of saying, well, here's a bureaucratic obstacle, let's get around this bureaucratic obstacle, let's legislate specifically, they said the following in the bill. And this is unbelievable for an American legislation. It says, the Secretary of Homeland Security shall have authority to waive all laws at his sole discretion.
What?
That's what it says. The second
thing. They don't even let the president do that, do they?
They don't let anybody do that. The second thing it says is that no court shall have jurisdiction to grant, to consider a plea for injunctive relief, declaratory judgment, or damages. In other words, the Secretary of Homeland Discretion, someone gets in the way, machine gun them. The Secretary of Homeland Security is the czar of all the Russias, King John before Magna Carta. Totally.
Do we still have a constitution? I mean, they've got the executive branch, they've got the legislative branch. Clearly, they want the judicial branch. How does it feel to be you right now, Representative Nadler? I mean, how are the Democrats feeling these days?
A lot of people feel very frustrated, obviously. And I am the ranking Democrat on the Constitution Subcommittee.
Well, that's why I wondered.
Which, until the Republicans took over, was known as the Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights and Civil Liberties. They got rid of the rights and civil liberties in the name right away.
Oh, wow.
So I get all these things first, and it's very frustrating, but you have to hope that the courts will rein them in somewhat, and the courts are reining them in somewhat. Even look at this right-wing Supreme Court, didn't let them get away totally. They put some limits on the enemy combatants doctrine, which was the most subversive doctrine, subversive American liberty, and God knows how long.
Mm. Our guest is Congressman Gerald Nadler. He represents the 8th District here in New York City. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Congressman, we want to switch gears a little and talk about Social Security, because that is one battle that the Democrats, I believe, will win. Stay with us. It's Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition
on our highest-rated, most respected news show in America.
On Air America Radio.
Weather. Ten minutes before the hour, and as Mark Maron would say, we're going to land this thing. It's Air America Radio's Morning's Edition. Mark's on vacation. He'll be back next week tomorrow morning. Ellis Hennigan from New York Newsday. Do they still call it New York Newsday?
Newsday.
Newsday, New York. He will be here with us as our special guest co-host right now. Laura Flanders is our guest co-host. And let me tell you, it's been really, really great
it's
having
Laura.
It's
always fun with you, Mark. Really, always a blast. And the time goes by so fast. What happened?
I don't know. But we got Congressman Gerald Nadler here. And, you know, he's making our time go by faster in the last half hour. We've been talking about the Schiavo case. And we also want to talk about a couple of other cases.
Well, you want to talk about Social Security, yeah. And I wanted to talk about the National Guard and the recruitment age. First, Social Security. Is the president's plan, such as it is, who knows, dead in your view?
Well, the current version of it is sinking fast. I'm somewhat worried that he'll come up with some sort of compromise and be able to put that over as a great concession, but that it would really be a disaster at those under the tent. I think what we have to understand, what most Democrats won't say, because the AFL-CIO polls say that if you say this, no one believes you afterward, but it is the truth, and that is that there is no, that unless the economy goes into a 1930-style depression and stays there for 60 years, Social Security is flush for a century. There is no solvency problem for Social Security.
And if it goes into that depression, the private accounts won't do anybody any good either.
Well, the private accounts would make it worse. but the fact is that when you see these claims that in 2042 or 2052, Social Security won't have the money to pay all this, that's based on the assumption of an economic growth rate of 1.6% a year. We've averaged 3.5% since the Civil War.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, Congressman, is there is an Easter recess coming up, and people like yourself go back to your districts. What can people who care about this issue do? Can they come knock on your door? I mean, this is a chance where people can speak to their representatives,
people,
right?
People should, at any time, they can send mail or email to their Congress members. They can phone them. These things are recorded and counted. Not every congressman sees every letter, but he's told we got 353 pro and 278 against. With Congress members in their districts, you can see them at breakfast, lunches, functions of various types, and you can express your concerns.
Now, Congressman, I don't know if the president has actually left this crack in the door, but the Treasury Secretary the other week seemed to hold open the possibility that these private accounts could be opened without benefit cuts as an ancillary or supplemental addition to Social Security. Can that be done fiscally?
Not now, no. President Clinton proposed, and everybody forgets Vice President Gore proposed, to open these kind of accounts over and above, not instead of Social Security, funded by a part of the huge surplus which we had.
We don't have that now.
That's the problem. If you were going to do that now, you'd have to plunge the country deeper into debt. And one of the problems now, and people don't really talk about this, we spend, ever since Medicare was adopted in 1965, the federal budget is 20 to 22% of GDP every year. When a Skinflinson office is 20.1%, when a Spencerson office is 21.7%, but between 20 and 22%. Tax revenues have been between 20 and 21%. With the Bush tax cuts, tax revenues are now running at 16 to 17%.
Ooh, built-in gap.
Built-in, huge, long-term, $450 billion gap. The spending cuts they want to make are nonsense in terms of the deficit, even though they're harsh. They are starving the beast. But what that means, because it's not just starving the beast, it's having huge long-term structural deficits. Structural meaning that even if the economy is flying, you're going to have a huge deficit. 80% of that money is being borrowed abroad from China. It's mortgaging our future, mortgaging our foreign policy, and eventually the Chinese and other people, if we don't change our ways, are going to start saying, hey, maybe we got to get out of the dollars. And then the economy will go over a real cliff. Mm. So we can't start hugely increasing the deficit at this point.
Very quickly, the Army has raised the age limit for recruits from 34 to 39 when applying for the National Guard and the Army Reserves. Clearly, they're worried about failures to meet their recruitment goals. You've been talking about the possibility of a military draft. What difference do you think this measure will make?
Well, I haven't been talking about the possibility of a military draft. Charlie Rangel has. I don't think we're going to have a military draft. I think what this shows is the misuse of the National Guard and the reserves. They're meant for emergencies. They're not meant for long-term deployments. Retention and recruitment is getting more difficult, obviously, because it's one thing for a soldier to go abroad for a year. It's another thing to take someone out of his job, away from his family. Maybe he loses his job, or while he's being in the National Guard in Iraq or Afghanistan for a year, he's getting the lower salary and he can't pay the mortgage, and we make no provisions for that. It's very wrenching to take people out of civilian life for extended periods of time, and so they're not going to have a lot of reenlistments. And if we're going to have these military deployments, and whether we should is another question, obviously, but if you're going to, then you have to have a larger regular army and not depend so much on the National Guard. And they're not willing to admit that. They're not willing to do what is necessary to implement their policy. If they want to implement their policy, they have to change. They have to have a larger army and a and not depend on the National Guard. And if they don't want to do that, they would have a different policy.
Right.
Which we would have in any event.
Congressman Gerald Nadler, thank you, first of all, for being with us. Thanks for fighting the good fight in the Capitol. And I hope you keep Amtrak, okay? I love Amtrak.
Well, we're going to try to keep Amtrak.
Right.
I use it all the time.
Yeah, I love it. I enjoy it. I love rail travel. Lord, it's one of those pet things of mine, you know. So I hope they keep it.
It's insane to become more truck and bus dependent.
Right now,
I
hear the fax machine is from the Streisand compound, and we've got Kent the Colonel Jones with the liberal agenda.
Here we go. It's a special World Water Day plus one edition. One, rent DVD of Lawrence of Arabia. If that doesn't remind you how important water is, nothing will. Two, support experimental like water for chocolate initiative. Three, as an experiment, shower with sand and brush your teeth with a twig. Four, at the restaurant, when the waiter brings you water, ask him, could you send that to the Sudan, please? Five, today's phrase, just dropping into conversation. You know what water is, man? Two parts hydrogen, one part oxygen, and a billion parts politics, man. Wake up, sheeple. It's going to be a dry summer.
Go get him, Kent Jones. Thank you very much. Congressman Gerald Nadler, thank you again. Laura Flanders has been a guest. We got to do this again
sometime soon.
All right. We are going to be back with you tomorrow morning, and our special guest from Newsday is none other than Ellis Hennekin. Have yourselves a great day, folks. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.